It's time for your weekly fix of wrestling nostalgia when we look at wrestling's past eras from the Attitude Era to the Reality Era.
I'd like to think that maybe this company will be better after Vince McMahon's dead, but the fact is, it's going to get taken over by his idiotic daughter and his doofus son-in-law and the rest of his stupid family.
To today. Here on the WWE Podcast.
Welcome to the WWE Podcast. It is Wednesday. I had to think about it. Wednesday, December 4th, 2019. Thank you guys for joining me. And awesome show today as we have a host, a co-host that you guys are familiar with to discuss our wrestling nostalgia. And Anthony DeMarco comes here and joins us as we discuss a match that I've never mentioned ever on this show. WrestleMania 23, HBK versus John Cena in what was a transitional match in so many ways for the industry, for the competitors individually, specifically John Cena, who was then going to be the true face of WWE moving forward for the next, my God, almost decade. So much happened in this match in terms of not just the match itself, which was outstanding from so many different perspectives, but again, also the individuals. So Anthony and I get into that. We discuss some current issues, current topics, Seth Rollins' heel turn, a lot of different angles in terms of comparing this match, of what the magnitude of it meant, and comparing it to today. And a lot of things that we discussed, we do compare it to today and find some holes. And we, you know, say, hey, what was so significant about this match? Why isn't it able to be translated to today? So we break that down. Always a great guest, great co-host, rather. And he'll be back also this weekend as we do our wrestling and review, weekend review. So a lot of good stuff coming your way. And very excited to bring it to you. But first, I want to let you guys know you can head on over to Patreon if you want an ad-free version of this show. You can definitely head over there and get an ad-free experience and erase all these all ads and plugs. So you can do that and get a shout-out and come on the show and do your own podcast if you so choose. So head on over there and also head on over to the website at wwepodcast.com if you want to get a full view of all of our shows and get on and read the blogs. We, believe it or not, have blogs that I write and other contributors write on the website. So I'd encourage you to check that out as well. And if you don't have iTunes or Apple Podcasts, well, no problem. There's tons of other places that this show's available, including CastBox, Google Podcasts, or Google Play, I should say, Spreaker, Spotify, TuneIn, Radio.com, anywhere that podcasts are available, this show will be available for you. So no fear. This show is everywhere. So if you hate the show, that's not good news, right? But anyway, if you know me, you know there are three things that I love in this world. Wrestling, talking about wrestling, and farts. I know what you're thinking. Hey, I love me some farts too, but with my busy schedule, how can I get the latest daily release of farts that I want and need? Worry no more, friends, because that's where my most favoritest podcast comes in to squeeze out some deuce juice, free decibels into your ears every 24 hours. Your fart of the day, whether it's smooth and loose or tight and taut, your fart of the day has them all. They're 100% fresh, 100% real, and 100% awesome. Don't take my word for it. Subscribe to them yourself through your favorite podcast network. Not everyone can fart every day, but everyone can squeak out some time to download your fart of the day. It's available on iTunes Podcast, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Spreaker, Overcast, Radio Republic, or directly from the source at anchor.fm/FOTD. That stands for fart of the day. Check them out now. I know I will. All right, guys. Well, here we go. We're going to get to my conversation with Anthony DeMarco on HBK versus John Cena, WrestleMania 23. I'll be back on Saturday or Sunday, probably Saturday, on the Wrestling in Review, Week in Review. And don't forget, tomorrow we'll be doing some AEW review and Friday some NXT review for you guys as Chris and Zach Perez come to you as part of the WWE podcast team to cover both the NXT and AEW shows. So three more shows to go this week, and hope you enjoy them. All right, guys, let's get to the conversation. As always, I'll talk to you next time. All right, it's Wednesday night. That means it's Wrestling Nostalgia, and typically I don't have a guest. However, this is a very special Wrestling Nostalgia night because I haven't spoken with Anthony in a while, and it's great to have him back, and we have a topic that I've never discussed on this show, maybe not even mentioned in passing, and in HBK versus John Cena, but more importantly, I'm welcoming back to the show the co-host of the WWE podcast, Anthony DeMarco. Welcome back, and I'm really excited to talk about tonight's topic.
Great to be back, man. I'm really looking forward to this show.
Yeah, I am too, and I know that you're the one that asked to do this, and I said, why have I never done this one, right? It's such a, I think, under-discussed, really an underestimated match that happened at WrestleMania 23, and just coming off of watching that shortly earlier this evening, I said, oh my God, this is a match that should be studied. And it went 30 minutes, and we're going to get into all of that, but it was a match that I think guys and gals today could sit down and realize that you don't need to do, 450 splashes and suicide dives, and overkill to have an awesome 4.5-star to five-star match. And so we're going to get into that and definitely get your thoughts on it, of course. But before we get into that, just want your thoughts overall on just the current product of the Seth Rollins heel turn that is not quite a total turn yet, but definitely heading that way. What's your thoughts on that? Obviously, The Fiend with Universal Championship has his own belt now. Daniel Bryan got his hair pulled out, so we're all looking to see what he looks like this week. What are your thoughts on everything going on?
Well, I think with Seth Rollins, it's a good change of pace. He was getting really stale, at least in my mind. He just became a big panderer to the crowd, and I got fed up with him pretty much almost like right after he won the Universal Championship at Mania. But it's good to see WWE kind of playing to what the crowd wants. He still is, like you mentioned, he's not fully turned yet, and that's pretty cool because it's a believability factor that he's like slowly but surely starting to snap at people, and like he's claiming that's for the greater good, but he's getting more and more annoyed, and he's still pandering to the crowd, like his attempted apology at Kevin Owens. So I think it's really good on WWE to, have a slow burn as opposed to, let's say, he would have aligned with the Authors of Pain right off the bat, and just jump right into it. I think this is drawing us out and, piquing our attention. And I like how they've incorporated the Authors of Pain. They're a tag team that since they came up, even before they had a hiatus, I really liked. I think that aligning with a guy like Seth Rollins would be pretty cool for them. As as his heavies, because I think the only thing that lacks with the Authors of Pain is the language barrier, and I know that's part of their gimmick, but I think long term it would be smart to align with a guy like Seth Rollins, who has a big pedigree like Seth Rollins.
Definitely, like this is a program of Seth, as you mentioned. He is a babyface in denial, but we know he's all turning heel. And Seth went recently on WWE backstage, and beyond him trying to get CM Punk, face to face, which that's a whole nother topic for, 2 hours of a show. Beyond that, he was asked about the negative reaction, and, he said it's just the cool thing to boo the top guys in WWE. He said Roman went through it, John Cena went through it, Bret Hart went through it. And I'm thinking, well, see, here's the thing. It's not because people deem it the cool thing to do. People, I don't believe that fans pay their money to go to a show and just do what's cool. People genuinely react out of real emotion, I believe. So people are genuinely booing Seth Rollins, not because it's the cool thing to do, which is what I think management's probably filling in his head, but it's because of the fact of the consistently awful, oftentimes bad booking, the chemistry or lack of with Becky Lynch on screen,
The fact that he just pandered to the audience consistently, almost to a nauseating state, pandering to the audience. It's a litany of things that have built up on top of you put the Hell in a Cell finish in there, and man, you've got yourself a heel in the making. So I don't think it's the cool thing to do that WWE likes to, I guess, use as their excuse for when their top guys get booed. And so I don't know. Those are my thoughts on that. What did you think about? I don't know if you heard about his backstage comments on the show, but do you think people are booing him because it's the cool thing to do?
I mean, maybe on some level, but I think this goes back to probably it really kind of caught fire or traction after Hell in a Cell. And Hell in a Cell was just they booked themselves into a corner. The Fiend still has damage on him. Seth has clearly gone down a heelish path because of it. That Hell in a Cell match had so many ripple effects in the most negative of ways, and you're still seeing it today. And it's truly unfortunate because I found, obviously, The Fiend is still arguably the best thing they have going right now, but he was even hotter before that, and you had a big babyface in Seth that nobody was really booing before that match. But I remember I was on the show, I think in August or something, and I said that I was growing tired of Seth Rollins a bit, that he had a very John Cena-esque feel about him. And I think it was just everything kind of came at once where everyone had enough with him just about the time where The Fiend and him had that awful Hell in a Cell match. But I mean, good on WWE for recognizing it and slowly transitioning him into a heel, because the worst thing they possibly could have done for Seth Rollins at the very moment would just be continuing him down that same, you know, path of just pandering and pure babyface.
No, I absolutely give WWE credit. I applaud them, and I will be the first to give them the credit where it's due that, hey, you guys aren't fighting upstream like they've done with others, but other than Roman Reigns, which seems to be the only immune superstar from heel turns, I mean, you look at the rest of the roster that you never thought they'd turn heel, like Bayley and Daniel Bryan, Finn Balor, and turn back to a heel. Guys and gals that you never, ever would think that they would turn heel, they've done, with the exception of, Mr. Immunity. And so, yes, I'm really intrigued to where this is going. I said that they either need to, A, which was my preference, have him go away for a couple of months, have him re-debut in the Rumble if they wanted to continue on the babyface path, or B, the second option would be to turn him heel, and they've done that, but in a way that, as you said, is believable, it's organic, it's not sudden, it's as if he's a babyface that still thinks he's the good guy, and he is just, as you said, continually getting more and more annoyed. The alliance of AOP, I love. Eventually, there will be a three-person trio, and I think that there's a lot of value and a lot of intrigue and really viability in that group. And yes, the language barrier with AOP is I think a problem. I would like WWE to not lean so much on the heels speaking in a different language to just be annoying to the crowd, because I think that's kind of go away heat of like, huh, I don't even know what they're saying. I mean, it's annoying, but not in a way that is good heat. It's just kind of like, okay, we get it. You're speaking your language, so we're supposed to be annoyed that we can't understand you. I think it's a little overdone. We have other acts in WWE that are doing that. I mean, look at the Kabuki Warriors. They're doing the same thing. And yes, they legitimately have an issue with the English language. Maybe it would benefit them to actually learn the English language rather than just leaning on, well, we know our language and we're heels. We can just use our language because it gets us heat. But I do really, really like what they're doing with AOP, and who eventually will become the leader of whatever this to-be-named group is of Seth Rollins.
Yeah, it's gonna give a different feel for Seth Rollins, and I think it will. Well, obviously these guys will have much more legitimacy, but maybe bring back a feel of when he had J&J Security, and he had a very successful run from 2014 that, 14 that spilled into 2015 before he ultimately got injured right before Survivor Series and had to give up the belt. But I mean, for the most part, I've really enjoyed Raw. And, I've even enjoyed, to a certain extent, the Lana and Lashley and Rusev thing. Not so much the storyline, but more the fact that they've made a significant effort to involve guys like Rusev and Lashley. And I've always liked storylines that, you know, they don't necessarily have to involve a belt. It's more personal. The execution has been off. You know, Lana's brutal when she's on the mic. But, I mean, it's made me at least care more about Lashley and Rusev, who were two guys I liked, but before this, I really didn't care about. So while the execution has been a bit off, I've really appreciated the, you know, the idea and goal in mind here.
I lost it. Yeah, no, I totally agree. I do appreciate that as well. I think that they do have a goal in mind. I'm on board for it. I was originally saying, why are they trying to turn him? You know, I actually wasn't a fan of them turning him heel because I think that there's some juice left in the squeeze of him as a babyface. But yeah, in general, I'm intrigued. And as you said with the Bobby Lashley and Lana thing, I originally despised this angle. I said that this is one of the worst things that they've done in a while. It's Vince McMahon's brainchild, no doubt, and I know that it is still to this day. But for whatever reason, you know, the audience keeps reacting, and it is slightly, in my mind, it's getting a little more watchable. Lana is still awkward on the mic, no doubt. Lana is just kind of, I don't know. Sometimes she's on the right track in her pace and her cadence and her promos. And there's other times she's acting, you know, as if she's, you know, some high school cheerleader that is, you know, fighting with her boyfriend. And it's a little bit of an immature type of act. And maybe that's the purpose, but I don't know. So in general, I'm not turning the channel per se. Not that any of us really have cable anymore, but I'm not turning the channel per se. I'm more intrigued than I was. And from things I'm reading, they actually are planning on continuing this past TLC. I wouldn't be surprised. I don't know what the end game is here. Maybe it is a ladder match with Bobby Lashley and Rusev, and hanging above the ring is, you know, a marriage license for Lana or something like that. I mean, I'm thinking, I don't know what's going to happen at the end of this. And I don't know. I mean, I'm on board for it, but reluctantly. It's kind of a weird feeling that I have for this angle. But was there anything else that you wanted to touch on about the current events before we jump into Cena and HBK?
Yeah, just one thing, and it's been mostly positive. But you know, I thought about this as soon as they did the latest installment of the brand split, and I saw kind of like where the stars were falling. And then as soon as Bray Wyatt won the WWE Championship, I was watching it with my girlfriend. I turned to her and I said, watch this. He's bringing that title over to SmackDown, and Roman Reigns is going to win the Rumble, and he's going to dethrone him at WrestleMania. And that was just me speculating. Then a few weeks ago, I heard you bring it up on the show. And now I'm actually reading online that this seems to already be set in stone by Vince McMahon. And to me, it kills this for me on so many levels. One, I was really hoping that Drew McIntyre was going to win the Rumble and turn babyface and go after Brock for the belt. But even more so than just my own personal preference, it killed the fact of like any kind of suspense for the Rumble that in my mind is the best pay-per-view of the year. So just hearing that come through the waiver wire, after I, you know, thought about that as soon as Bray Wyatt won the championship, has really just dampened my, you know, hype leading into the Royal Rumble.
No. So I haven't been dipping into the news wire on that front, but I would believe that what you're saying is in fact true, that you know, it is set in stone that Roman Reigns is probably going to win the Rumble this year. You know, the disaster that happened in Philadelphia in what, 2015, that was 5 years ago. This one is in Houston, Texas this year. So probably a little bit more friendly of an audience. And you know, to be honest, the crowd reactions to Roman Reigns have been much more positive, but I have said, I don't know if you've listened to this show where I commented that, yeah, the positive reactions have been more frequent and louder, but I think it's a result of those who have been booing him. Mainly the males 18 to 34 are probably the ones that haven't really connected with him and still haven't connected with him. But I think those folks have actually just been kind of quiet and, you know, maybe applauding at the end of a match or whatever. And I think it's more of just those who have booed him in the past are now just kind of being quieter and allowing those who traditionally have liked the Roman Reigns character to, you know, seem like they're the majority when it's actually the, you know, the other 60% are just sitting there and probably not cheering for him, but just maybe clapping or whatever. And I think what's going to happen, and I would assume WWE would look at this as a possibility, is once Roman Reigns gets back into the title picture, I think that those fans that have been quiet or, you know, during this whole cancer remission and feel good story, and, you know, Roman's really kind of been out of the title picture for a while. But once he's back in it, I think it's going to bring back all of those feelings that those individuals had about him carrying the belt and being the chosen one and them refusing to turn him heel. I think a lot of that's going to come rushing back. And WWE can say that they haven't been focusing on Roman Reigns. He hasn't had the belt. But look who is headlining shows. Look who opens shows, closes shows, is the face of video games, is the face of their trucks and their promotions and their magazines. So they can say that Roman Reigns hasn't been the focus of the company. And they may have a lot of people fooled. They don't have me fooled. He has still been the focus of the organization because look what they did with Kofi Kingston. He was still the focus of the entire show of who done it, who attacked Roman Reigns, and Kofi would get the second to last slot or somewhere in the middle. And, you know, yeah, it was Kofi, but the WWE Championship was put at second, the second stone to Roman Reigns and the who done it. So I think that this could end up backfiring on them come Royal Rumble.
Yeah, well, you know, I've said for the last couple of years that if they're going to keep deploying Roman Reigns as the main guy, you might as well put the belt on him so that he can, you know, make that belt relevant and the championship isn't being overshadowed. So it's not so much that I'm against him winning the championship, but it's like, come on, like, you just spent all this time building up the Fiend. Now you're doing damage control on the Fiend. And, like, he's just going to come in, win the Rumble, and predictably go over at WrestleMania. And it's just, it just seems like he's going to come in and just kill something that has arguably been the best thing that WWE has had in the last number of years. So I'm trying not to be too bullish on Roman Reigns because I feel like a lot of, you know, the things that people resent about him aren't his fault, and it is on WWE booking. And, you know, when he comes out now, like, I kind of laugh because, like, even his theme song, the way it starts, it's almost like it's a big, giant troll by WWE. That's how it feels like at this point. I think you brought it up with Michael Cole, how he introduces him. It just feels like a big, giant troll job, and it shouldn't with the top guy. So it's not so much that I mind that he's eventually going to win back the Universal Championship, but it's more like in this fashion that they're going to do it. And to the point you just brought up, and I don't mean to sound, you know, critical or controversial here, but we know that the only reason that he isn't getting booed out of the building right now is because of the whole cancer thing. And I'm not, like, it's not a genuine like for the guy. It's a genuine respect to not boo him. And that's what WWE probably just hasn't picked up on yet.
Yeah, I still think that grace period of the cancer remission. And look, I mean, as much as I don't like the babyface Roman Reigns character, I've said this before, I'll say it again, I would draft him in my top three if I was creating a roster. I think he's that good. I just think that he's been miscast for so damn long and the fans haven't got a chance to hate him in a true heel role where I thought a lot of his money was, and then turn him babyface. Every top guy in the company that's ever had a huge impact on the industry has had a heel run. It's just cyclical. It's part of how you create a massively successful babyface. And the constant resistance and war of attrition with Vince McMahon and the fans is not going to do him any favors, I believe. And to your point about The Fiend, if he is going to be a sacrificial lamb, if he's just being built so that Roman Reigns can take him down at 36, that's going to be, I think, a whole nother, you know, what storm in Tampa. I mean, the Fiend, the most beloved character since I don't even know what. Yes, a ton of damage was still done at Hell in a Cell, and that's going to linger for a while. but this is a beloved character. It was a organic, organic brainchild from Bray Wyatt, not from WWE creative. It feels real. It's interesting. It's intriguing. It has so many unique factors to it. There's so much there, and we haven't even scratched the surface with probably what the Fiend can, you know, what's going to happen with him, and obviously his other half of the Firefly Funhouse Bray Wyatt version. But if at WrestleMania 36 it's going to be Roman Reigns taking him down, I don't believe the crowd is going to respond positively to that. And, you know, clearly Bray Wyatt's going to be positioned as the heel. They are trying to use every sympathetic figure, including legends, to position Wyatt as a heel. And I just still am not feeling Bray Wyatt as a heel. He's just too damn intriguing and interesting. And it's such a unique character for, you know, the constant just cookie cutter mold of wrestlers that WWE has at times. To have him so much different than everyone else, it's going to be really hard, especially on a WrestleMania audience, to get him over as a heel and cheer, Roman Reigns, the guy that they've been trying to tell WWE to turn heel for, 7 years now? So it's going to be a hard sell. I'm interested to see this damn match and see how the crowd reacts, but I'm with you. I still think at the end of the day, it's going to be Roman Reigns standing at the fireworks go off around the stadium, Roman Reigns holding that belt and the crowd booing. I just see it.
Yeah, it's going to be real tough to watch, but in the meantime, let's get into some HBK and Cena. I'm really looking forward to this.
Yeah, definitely. So, you brought up the topic, and it's a hell of a topic, and a really good one that I can't believe I never thought of. So props to you. So you're the one that brought it up. Start us off. Where do you want to begin with this program?
Well, you know, I think it really all started when, following WrestleMania 21, John Cena had won the WWE Championship from John Bradshaw Layfield at in L.A., and they swapped him and Batista on shows. Batista took the World Heavyweight Championship to SmackDown. Cena took the Raw WWE Championship, the WWE Championship to Raw. So his first year on Raw, he had feuds with Chris Jericho. He had a feud with Kurt Angle, a brief one. Then he dropped the belt momentarily to Edge and gained it back a few weeks later at the Royal Rumble. And then he had that match with Triple H. But the feud, I found, left something to be desired a bit with Triple H. And it was just kind of a one-off match. And then he had a longer feud with Edge and what have you. But when it finally came full circle in 2007 with Shawn Michaels, it felt like the first, actually important feud with John Cena. He hadn't yet feuded with Orton. He hadn't yet feuded with Batista. He hadn't faced The Rock. This was Cena's, at least in my mind, his first important feud as the face of the company. And Shawn Michaels obviously was 2 years out of retirement, but he could still go right till the very last day. And even though Cena had fought Triple H at the WrestleMania before that, I guess it was maybe just the build that hampered the match a bit. The match itself was great, but there just wasn't a good build, at least in my mind. But this one, they went in as tag team champions, Cena and HBK. They had this amazing build, and I remember the promo was just so perfectly done. You know, the music, the production, it made the match feel like so important, something that really lacks in WWE nowadays. And it went on, it was a perfect length, I believe it was half an hour long, and it just felt like something for Cena, that this was almost like, you know, the icing on the cake, his third consecutive main eventing of WrestleMania, and it was like this was kind of the match that crowned him officially as the face of the future, because we still at this point weren't sure if it was Batista, still wasn't sure if it was Randy Orton, you know, Mr. Kennedy was up and coming, Bobby Lashley was there, it was still left to be determined who was actually going to be the face. But I felt after this match, when all was said and done, it was clear cut that Cena was, at least in my mind at the time, rightfully the guy to take WWE into a new era.
This was John Cena's coming out party. This put to rest anyone's doubt this guy was going to indeed be not a flash in the pan, not just a McMahon project that, you know, he was going to decide on next week. I don't know why I was seeing in him. You know, we're going to move on from somebody else. This was indeed the solidification of John Cena as we know him today. You could really point to this. And as you said, yes. I mean, if you should go back to all the way to WrestleMania 20 when he had his match with the Big Show, I believe, for the United States Championship. I remember watching that Madison Square Garden and seeing that, and, you know, seeing him FU, as it was then known, only to become the AA in the PG era, seeing him FU the Big Show, WrestleMania 20. And then, as you said, WrestleMania 21, 22 with Triple H. And now when you get to WrestleMania 23, and certainly it does not hurt being in the ring with one of the best of all time, if not the best of all time, in Shawn Michaels. And, you know, this was a match that I'm sad that we never got to see a WrestleMania rematch between these two. Yes, we saw a Survivor Series match in 2009 with a triple threat between Triple H, HBK, and John Cena, but it wasn't the same. It wasn't a classic, and it's not easy to repeat these types of matches. And the pacing of this match, just the psychology, and having Jim Ross and Jerry the King Lawler on commentary, the greatest duo in wrestling announcing history, certainly helps with Jim Ross's just uncanny ability to make you feel emotion and focus on the match and talk about what's happening in the ring and not talk about social media, which obviously wasn't as big 13 years ago, but to actually just say, hey, call what's in front of you instead of this nonsensical, you know, sometimes off the cuff stuff that takes you away from the match, some, you know, nowadays. All of that combined, it was a brilliant match. Excellently paced, and they didn't have to do, you know, 400 flip-flop moves that, you know, you see today, which is, you know, it's no slam on the guys and gals today. It was just, it's a different style that, you know, it showcases that you don't need to always do that style to have a five-star match.
Yeah, and it was the thing about this match, and I'm obviously speaking from a personal standpoint, but it was the end of an era, and it closed the book on the Ruthless Aggression era. And this was the last WrestleMania that I watched where I followed the product religiously, right up until probably WrestleMania 28 in 2012 when The Rock came back. So I had probably like a 4 or 5 year gap following this match because I knew that things weren't going to be the same. It was like almost like I had a gut feeling that once this match was over, it was a changing of the guard. And, you know, like I said, Shawn Michaels retired 2 years later and they kind of like abolished the brand split, and Triple H slowly but surely moved into more of a management role. So it really, for so many different reasons, just hit home with everything. And I think that it was a slow, methodical match, to your point. Shawn Michaels, you know, what better of a guy to have a match with and put you over the top. But, you know, I wasn't the biggest John Cena fan, but now that he's gone, you kind of realize what he was. And I wasn't the biggest fan of him, but, like, thinking back on how long he worked for the company, some of the matches he had, and looking back at this is his coming out party, and the first, you know, initial start of his reign, it makes you grow an appreciation for him, that even he was the first of his kind, at least since Hulk Hogan, but at least there was, like, you know, a 20-year gap. And I guess, like, when it was happening, I wasn't really interested in the Cena character, but looking back, maybe I took him a bit too much for granted.
Amazing how we feel about someone when, you know, they're no longer there. You realize the value that they carried and added to this. And yeah, John Cena not being here anymore, definitely, you know, it leaves something to be desired. As much as, like you said, I wasn't a fan of John Cena either, as far as his, you know, sometimes his character was a little bit hokey, or some, whenever he would get comedic, that to me was not what he should be doing. It's, you know, he would try to be funny on camera, and more often than not, it didn't work. But when it came to promos, this guy could cut a promo. I mean, when he came back and faced The Rock, I thought The Rock was going to torch him, and it was the other way around. I mean, Cena just manhandled him on the mic. Rock had some good shots, and, you know, without writing it on his arm to remember it, he did have some good shots. And I just think that it was that, and I know we're not talking about The Rock and Cena, but that to me was, as we're kind of reminiscing about the career of John Cena, that really was spoke volumes to me that, hey, you know, John Cena is legit. He is, I think, quicker on his feet than almost anybody, if not anybody, on the current roster today. He can think on his feet. He can cut a promo that no one else can cut with just bullet points given to him from creative. And the promo, like you said, the build to this match, I think the promos that they had were really good. And I just wish there was a rematch, and we obviously didn't get that. But with 30 minutes to have this match, 30 minutes to tell a story, sometimes it's not always about having more time. But when you have a ring general in there with Shawn Michaels and somebody that's as hungry as John Cena was back in 2007, April 1st, you have a combination for a five-star match. And in front of 80,000 people who I would think were clearly pro-HBK and anti-Cena. It wasn't, you know, 90-10, and probably more like 70-30 when you listen to the reaction. It also, I think, hardened John Cena to learn how to understand, deal with audiences that don't go along with the narrative that the storyline's trying to tell. And he dealt with it the year before with Triple H, and, you know, I think that that's where he got his first taste of it on a stage of that magnitude. But it also followed up at WrestleMania 23 with, you know, you had a lot of let's go Cena sucks, but the majority, I think, were booing John Cena.
Yeah, well, because I'm glad you brought up WrestleMania 22 with Triple H, because that was the first time that Cena really got booed. Because before that, you know, he was getting cheered all the time, like a, you know, prototypical babyface. But even by the time he got to WrestleMania 23 against Shawn Michaels, it wasn't a full-on switch yet that we saw in, like, the early 2010s. To your point, there was still at least 30% of the audience that was behind Cena. So it wasn't, like, that overwhelmingly, like, against negative Cena feel that we had become accustomed to in the latter half of his career. But, you know, there was just so many aspects of this match. Like I said, they beat Rated RKO for the Tag Team Championships, I think, a month before this match happened. Then they had a sequence of tag team matches against Batista and Undertaker from SmackDown, and they were the SmackDown main event. And, you know, it was just like that whole, like, drawn-out thing, like, if Cena was always watching his back, if Shawn Michaels was going to switch him, music him, and eventually he did. And it was just this whole trust thing with Cena, because it was just a psychological masterpiece was the build to this match. And then they translated it into the match. And it was just something that for me is like, when I look back, that is the last match that I think I ever saw from my childhood and the style of match that I really liked. So that's why I hold this match, you know, pretty close to my heart, because it was, at least in my mind, I know you talked about this match in particular last week, the end of an era match. This match was an end of an era for my personal childhood and my remembrance of the Ruthless Aggression era.
No, I can see, absolutely. I mean, not just for your childhood and your break from pro wrestling for the next few years, but yeah, I mean, it ended not just the Ruthless Aggression era into the PG era, but yeah, I mean, it solidified John Cena as a real deal guy. Like, this was, hey, Cena's here and he's here to stay. And I think one thing also that we didn't discuss about this match was not just the pacing, but you brought it up, the psychology. I mean, they started out not with punches and kicks and flips and power moves. When you look at this match from start to finish, they started out with kind of like, you know, a little bit of tit for tat and a little bit of mind games and who's going to get the advantage. And they started out with chain wrestling, and it works up to, you know, more aggressive power moves. And then eventually they didn't actually throw a punch until about 15 minutes into the match. It's amazing. I mean, that's to me, like, how a match of this magnitude should be built. Not every match has to start out with punches and kicks and all this stuff. that's how you build it up to make it feel as if, you know, when you finally get to the finishing maneuvers, it feels like this really could be it. And they didn't kick out of six of their finishers. HBK kicked out of one FU, and Cena kicked out of one Sweet Chin Music after they hit the finishing maneuvers and then couldn't capitalize. So there was also that extra time to have to try to cover your opponent that you gave them. So the finishers were protected in an era that, you know, started to get overuse of finishers. And now, I mean, today's product, especially even on Raw, SmackDown, you expect people to kick out of finishes. I don't want that. So this was also masterful in psychology of how the match progresses step by step to get to that finish.
Yeah, and the thing that made this match so great was not even the fact that it was great, but like, look at what it headlined and came followed up after on the rest of the card. You know, you had Batista versus The Undertaker, and I believe that this was the first, I'm trying to think here, oh no, the year before Mysterio won the Royal Rumble and didn't main event, but Taker won the Royal Rumble, and I think that match went on before 9 o'clock, the Batista versus Undertaker one. And I think Batista's been pretty vocal about, like, being upset about that went on so early. And I remember watching that match and thinking, like, wow, that's really weird for, like, a world title match to go on. But then, you know, you had a 8-man Money in the Bank ladder match open WrestleMania, where you had the likes of CM Punk, Randy Orton, the Hardy Brothers, Edge, Mr. Candy, who ended up winning, Booker T, all in that match. You know, you had the hair versus hair match with now President Donald Trump versus Vince McMahon, Bobby Lashley versus Umaga, refereed by Stone Cold Steve Austin. You know, this was a star-studded, under-the-radar WrestleMania, at least in my mind. And like I said, when I was watching it, I truly, truly thought that Taker and Batista were going to go on last. You know, Taker hadn't been world champion, I think, since 2003 at this point. And, you know, it was the first time he'd ever won the Royal Rumble. But they elected to go with Cena and HBK, and it's just incredible how it just lived up and probably exceeded expectations.
No doubt that this, you know, that's kind of an interesting point to bring up, that this was an underrated WrestleMania when you look at up and down the card of what happened. And yes, John Cena and Shawn Michaels only came after Melina and Ashley. I mean, that's not exactly a, you know, a barn burner. So this clearly was positioned in an era where, you know, the women were nowhere near positioned the way they are today. This clearly was positioned as kind of a bathroom break. I mean, no disrespect to the women. That's kind of what it was, though. I mean, that's what it was. The match only lasted 3 minutes and 40 seconds, you know, in a lumberjill match for the WWE Women's Championship. So, you know, when you look at the rest of the card, yeah, I mean, my God, you have Mr. Kennedy, who was slotted to become and many thought would be, you know, the next Triple H or that level. People were believing that he could be. And to me, Mr. Kennedy is remembered most for obviously the microphone coming down and, you know, saying his name. But he was in Eddie Guerrero's final match ever. So I remember that very well. And you also had, yeah, the Bobby Lashley and Umaga match, which I also remember very well from this pay-per-view, as well as Undertaker and Batista, and Donald Trump taking one of the worst Stone Cold Stunners of all time in that match, which I still watch that, and it's almost embarrassing to watch it in slow motion, but pretty funny to think that Stone Cold stunned the President of the United States in front of 80,000 people. But yeah, this was a card up and down that when you look at the names now and you're looking at who is still here and actually, you know, potentially still able to perform, I mean, you're looking at, now, Punk, I'm going to keep out at this point. You Edge, although he's been rumored to come back, I don't know. I'll believe it when I see it. You have Jeff Hardy, unless he's, you know, still in jail or whatever he's doing. You have Randy Orton. You have Matt Hardy, Kane, Undertaker, I think. Batista's now retired. And Bobby Lashley. And that's it. I mean, John Cena, you could say, is still active. But so you're talking about, like, you know, out of 15 or 20 performers, maybe 5 of them are still active. And so, yeah, this was a card that I think people need to, you know, look at and go, there are some hidden gems in here, and obviously HBK and Cena tore the house down, but I think Undertaker Batista is also one that was, I don't think as technically sound, much more of a slugfest, but as it should be with Undertaker and Batista.
Yeah, and I guess, like, I'll go back to this point that it was, you still didn't know who the face was going to be. You know, like, John Cena had yet to take off, and you had guys like, you know, this was a time where, like, I remember Randy Orton, and I started kind of, like, realizing, like, man, like, are they just going away from him as possibly the face of WWE? And obviously, in the years preceding this, he formed Legacy, and, you know, he lived up to the expectations to a certain degree, but never quite to John Cena. And the same thing with Batista, and that was kind of evident when they swapped them, and it was just all a very interesting time in WWE where you weren't really sure what was next ahead for the company. And it was just like a perfect storm of almost like it almost had a feel like The Rock versus Hulk Hogan at WrestleMania 18, but the match was obviously light years better than that one was. But in the sense of like, this was like an old guy handing the reins over to the face, but even more so because, you know, Cena had his whole career ahead of him at this point, while The Rock, that we didn't know it then, but already had a foot out the door of WWE. So this was just a match that it really just told the story of not only the characters at hand, but it kind of told the story of the company at the time, that they were going to shift to a PG product in the very next year. And Shawn Michaels was, you know, fast pacing towards retiring just 2 years later. And that Cena was going to be the guy to lead the charge for the next decade for the WWE. And it was just so perfectly thought out. And, you know, we already touched on the build and the promo, and it just makes you think, like, why can't they do something like this? You know, they had a John Cena and Roman Reigns program, I believe 2 years ago, on Monday Night Raw, and, you know, nobody even remembers that, and it just makes you wonder as to why they can't do something similar like they did 13 years ago with Cena and HBK.
It does, and that match with Roman Reigns and John Cena, I think is something that was interesting on so many levels, and I was of the belief at the time when they did that I was concerned that the crowd was just going to turn on both of them and just you know, burn the match out and just, you know, you both suck. We, you know, whatever kind of chance were going to happen. But I think at that point, it was still John Cena who clearly was the top dog in that program. I mean, he was light years ahead of Roman Reigns in terms of the promo department, and Roman Reigns embarrassed himself, flat out embarrassed himself with promos against John Cena, and even got caught up in his words, forgot a part of what he was going to say, all that kind of stuff. And that's a really good point to bring up, that matches like this, where you don't know who the next face of WWE is going to be, and WWE trying to tell you who they want it to be, or who the fans want it to be, and also having it line up with WWE who they want it to be, it's easier said than done. I think at every WrestleMania, that is usually their goal. I mean, every year is not a transition year, but every year should be a year in which your WWE creative should be trying to make a statement of, this is going to continue to be our guy or gal, and or this is going to be, and is not yet, but will be, our guy or gal moving forward. This was a match that was just perfectly executed to solidify John Cena as that next face. We all thought it was a competition between John Cena and Batista. They seemed to be on an even keel for quite a while, even coming down to the Royal Rumble, them being the final two. I forget what Rumble that was. It might have been 2004. I don't remember. But it came down to those two, and it was symbolically telling you, we know that these are your two top guys, and it's just a way to show that, hey, we know that this is what it is. We know that you guys are, on an even keel or not sure where to go with this, and we're going to, you know, we're going to go a direction. We're going to put our foot down and we're just going to do this. And today it's not so much the case. It's just kind of wishy-washy. It's kind of 50-50 booking at times. Vince McMahon likes to tear up scripts 5 minutes before Raw. There's not, I think it boils down to, there's not a whole lot of long-term vision. It's a lot of here and now and not a lot of we want to take the ball and give it to whoever it may be, guy or gal, and have them be the next face of the company. I think a lot of times there's a lack of long-term vision and their concern of the audience, you know, turning on them because it's the cool thing to do.
Yeah, and, you know, it's kind of evident in, you know, the last 4 or 5 years, because I think the last true transitional WrestleMania, I would say, was WrestleMania 31 in 2015, where Rollins cashed in the Money in the Bank, because that was a year that, like, they kind of officially closed the book on, you know, guys like Randy Orton and John Cena and Sheamus, you know, like, basically all the faces of the PG era. At least in my mind, that WrestleMania 31 is where they closed it and they moved into, I don't know, the social media era, whatever you want to call
it. Well, I don't even know what it is, yeah.
Yeah, whatever you want to call WWE since then. And they handed it pretty much to all the former members of The Shield. And that's pretty much what happened. And it was cool. And I loved that cash-in. And I wasn't completely down on Roman Reigns at that point. Obviously, that was the peak of it. But I guess I was just a bit late to the party of growing to kind of just dislike the character. But since then, it was just Roman Reigns and Brock Lesnar being thrown in your face. And maybe I'm biased on Brock Lesnar because I just love the character. But, you know, WrestleMania 32, Roman Reigns versus Triple H. Well, that's anything but a transitional year. If anything, that's going backwards. Then you get Roman Reigns closing the show with Undertaker in Orlando. Kind of the same thing, you know, it living in the past a bit. Then you go back to the well with Roman Reigns and Brock Lesnar. And, you know, again, WrestleMania 34, it did nothing to transition into a new era. And then last year, it was kind of different because it was all about the women. And I guess you could say that it transitioned the face of women's wrestling to Becky Lynch. So in that regard, I can kind of understand. But, you know, the WWE Championship went to a placeholder in Kofi Kingston, and Seth Rollins just regained the world title, which he has had in the past. So I just feel like they've been kind of spinning their tires, not knowing who the face is. Like, we all kind of know it's Roman Reigns, but Brock has the belt all the time, so is it him? But he's in his early 40s and is only part-time. So is it Seth Rollins? But they've only been pushing Seth Rollins for about a year now as a top baby face. And now they're pulling the plug on him. And is it Daniel Bryan? But he's in and out. And, you know, AJ Styles could kind of been thrown into there. And it's just been a long time since I had a definitive guy that I could look at and say, that's the face. That's the guy that, even though the crowd doesn't like him now, when he was getting pushed, they were all behind him. And that was true with Cena. When he was face-to-face with Batista in the 2005 Royal Rumble as the final two, they were behind him. When he beat John Bradshaw at Layfield for the WWE Championship for the first time, the crowd was behind him. And he still had a solid supporting cast leading up to the HBK match, and I just, it's something that has lacked for the last 5 years or so.
You're right, I agree with everything that you've said about that. I think, though, if I'm WWE, I'm sitting here, if I'm listening to our conversation, probably saying, well, that's easier said than done, because guys like John Cena, guys like, you know, Stone Cold, The Rock, Triple H, you know, those are guys that you think of as faces of their generation. And guys like John Cena, who really was the last solidified babyface top guy for his generation, don't come around very often. And oftentimes, you know, the more they try to force it, or even if they have a vision and they try to force it, then the fans know they're forcing it, and then they reject it because you're trying to force it. It's this weird dynamic. And you know, these are very rare breeds. So the fact that, you know, we are pointing out that there hasn't been that one guy and now gal, which the women have made an incredible movement and, you know, props to them, is that, you know, it's not easy to identify who that is. And there, I think a lot of times we're now seeing just testing a lot of, well, let's push this guy for a little while or gal for a little while and see how the crowd reacts. And then if they don't get exactly what they're looking for or exactly what they thought, they pull back. And then they try this person and then they pull back, or this person, oh, work for a year, then pull back. And I think there's a lot of that going on. And I think it's partly due to a lot of fans' impatience. So I can't put it all on the company's creative. Fans are extremely impatient. I'm a very patient fan. I'm not saying I'm better and by any means. It's just that if fans don't have patience, then they're not going to allow guys and gals to have a slow burn and allow things to develop. They want everything here and now. And who's the next guy? Who's the next girl? Who's the next face of our generation? And with that impatience, it's going to inevitably have a negative effect on the perception that WWE doesn't know what they're doing. But maybe it doesn't look like they know what they're doing because the fans don't know maybe who they want, at least from a crowd reaction. You know, so the fans say that, WWE say they're listening to fans, but if fans flip flop, or if fans, you know, start to cheer one guy one week, boo one guy next week, and then they push one guy because the WWE thinks they, you know, that they got a great reaction for a while, and then the fans suddenly perceive, oh, the corporate machine's getting behind them, let's boo them. So I get also why WWE creative, again, they're not without sin, no doubt, but there also is the fan dynamic in an era where, hey, you know, social media and smartphones have taken over the world. We are in a gotta have it now world. And when fans have no patience, it doesn't allow creative to fully develop their stories.
Yeah, for that, you're absolutely right. Because, you know, one of my buddies and I we've always joked about it that, you know, there's a certain time, and you just said, as soon as the machine gets behind a character, no matter if the crowd liked him initially or not, they'll turn on him. And, you know, even in 2013-14, when the Daniel Bryan Yes movement took over WWE, I liked it and I'm happy that they did that and he's still a star today. But there was a point where I was watching and I'm just like, okay, so unless Daniel Bryan's winning every match and every title all the time on every show, they're going to be pissed off. Like, there was a certain point where I was just like, okay, like, stop. Like, it's annoying now. Like, just let the creative do it. Just, you know, there is something to be said about a time before the internet and the smartphones, like you just mentioned, took over, where not that we would just take everything that we were fed, but we allowed for things to develop and organically grow. And so for that, you're 100% right. And a lot of it does have to do with the fans, because it does seem on some level that no matter who they choose now, that is WWE, like, that the fans will revolt against in some way. But to the same effect, I feel like WWE just has a group of wrestlers that they have in mind that they could choose from. Like, okay, fans, here are the group of five wrestlers that you can get behind, and we'll go with that guy. And obviously it isn't always the case, as they pushed Kofi Kingston, but that was just 100% a write-off. I'm talking about like an actual serious push. And it seems as though that aside from the guys in the Shield and AJ Styles over the past 5 years, no one's really gotten a super, super heavy push that's carried out for more than a year. And, you know, I'll bring it back to what I said earlier on about the Royal Rumble. It's like, I feel like this is a time, a transitional WrestleMania, where you could drive Drew McIntyre to the top of the mountain, because I think they're really missing the opportunity with this guy. And I feel he's gotten a bit stale with the heel, you know, monster gimmick, but I feel like he's gotten away from that since coming back and since the newest rendition of the brand split. And I feel like this guy could be a really good babyface. And I think that, obviously, I don't think it's going to happen, but if he were to, you know, go up against Brock leading into WrestleMania, this could be a true opportunity that for WWE to, you know, put the rocket pack to a guy and give the reins to a guy for the next few years that isn't named anyone from the Shield or AJ Styles.
why they are not pushing Drew McIntyre while he's hot, while he's in his prime, is a cardinal sin. I have no reason in my mind why WWE is not just saying, look at this guy. He's got Vince McMahon's body, because we all know Vince McMahon is enamored with the prototypical wrestler body. He has the promo believability more than, I would say, 80% of the roster. When he speaks, I feel like he's speaking from his guts, not from a paper he read 5 minutes before he came out. He's got, obviously, the in-ring prowess. He is very well oiled in the ring. His finish is awesome. It's like a gunshot going off. And Akira Tozawa selling it this past week on Raw was just, oh my God, it was awesome. So I love his finish. I love his promos, his entrance, his believability, his presence. He has got everything. And I have no idea why. They had the perfect opportunity when he returned about a month ago to say, okay, finally, let's do this. And every time that he does come back, or they put him in a position that I say, okay, they're going to clearly have him win, like maybe win King of the Ring, they don't do it. And I just don't know why. I'm not understanding. And from what I'm understanding or reading from the rumor mills is that it's going to be Tyson or who is it? Brock Lesnar versus who's the guy that just came in and did the boxing with Braun Strowman? Tyson Fury. Yeah. So I said, yeah, Tyson Fury. So there, apparently that is the thinking for WrestleMania. And I'm thinking that's going to be a total disaster. I mean, I don't need to see that kind of, you know, well, Tyson Fury is not great in the ring. And, you know, I don't need that. It should be about Brock. And I think, as you said, Brock and Drew McIntyre. Drew McIntyre would be an amazing counter to Brock Lesnar, especially if you give Drew McIntyre a build starting at TLC. And I don't know. I could go on about Drew McIntyre forever. I've been talking about him forever. And I think even as a heel, he could be great. Right now, he's a heel. But if they're going to turn him face, I'm fine with that too. Or maybe trade him to SmackDown and where he could thrive there. So, I'm at a loss for words with Drew McIntyre of why he's not at the top of the card or is holding a championship at this point.
Yeah, you know, and it's like you said, it's not even like a situation like Samoa Joe or Kevin Owens where you could say like, oh, well, they're fat, so they're not going to get pushed. Like, this guy has the prototypical body. He's built like a Greek god, you know. My girlfriend drools all over him when he comes out. Like, my God, like the guy is a prototypical wrestler. And for whatever reason, they just won't pull the trigger. And I just think it comes back to that. You know, you have a group of five or six wrestlers that we're on board with you choosing with, but these are the guys that you're going to get. And it's between Brock and The Shield and AJ Styles for the most part, and now Daniel Bryan since he came back. But aside from that, you'll never really see a guy come out of the woodwork and get pushed. And, you know, like even Dolph Ziggler kind of suffered from that, you know, in the old times where it was basically John Cena, Randy Orton, and Sheamus, that no matter how hard they got behind Dolph Ziggler, he just could never take that next step to get on equal footing with the likes of those guys. And it's just weird because we were just talking about the Ruthless Aggression era where, like, almost year to year, it was like a different torch was being handed. You know, you got Brock Lesnar, you know, getting the torch at WrestleMania 19 when he beat Kurt Angle. Chris Benoit winning the World Heavyweight Championship, defeating HBK and Triple H in the triple threat match. And, you know, on SmackDown, Eddie Guerrero was the WWE champion. The very next year, you had the John Cena and Batista title victories. You know, the year after that, Cena retained the WWE championship, but then Rey Mysterio's, you know, 2-3 year push, like, went on. And, like, it's not always that you have to change the face of the company, but you have to introduce new elite talent to the top on a long-term basis. And I don't mean Kofi Kingston winning it for 9 months in like a, you know, a placeholder championship run and then going back to the tag team division immediately following. I'm talking about new faces reaching up into, you know, the top tier talent in WWE, like we saw John Cena do when he beat Shawn Michaels at WrestleMania 23. And it's just something that they just will not do unless it's from that one crop of five or six wrestlers.
There is. There's always this like pre-selected pool of candidates that WWE says, all right, well, pick some of these, but only these. You know, not going, don't go outside, which made what happened with Daniel Bryan that much more awesome. And obviously, we know the story that led up to WrestleMania 30 with Daniel Bryan. And I think what happened with that, clearly, WWE did not have a vision. Vince McMahon did not have a vision for Daniel Bryan doing what he did in main eventing WrestleMania 30. But what had happened, I think, is that the fans, realizing the power that they had and the influence that they had in that storyline to legitimately change the scope of the WrestleMania main event. I mean, that was a storyline, but it was a storyline based in 100% truth of the fans legitimately getting behind him on social media and in live shows. And it was a realization moment, an aha moment for the fans to say, hey, wait a minute. So we can actually have a crazy big influence. If we band together, we can decide who we want in the main events of WrestleManias and who we want as champions. And with that new realized power, fans, I think at times obviously have been very divisive on, you know, Roman Reigns and John Cena and all, you know, but they've taken that power, and I think WWE has realized that the fans realize they have that power, and they think maybe they're abusing that power and just playing games at times with WWE, doing what they deem as, well, whatever is cool, which I don't believe to be true, but nonetheless, it's this constant battle of WWE saying they listen to us, and yet we'll boo the hell out of somebody, and they either don't turn them heel, or we cheer them and they don't make them champion, or they go down the card, or creative is messing with them. It's this very complicated, and it shouldn't be, dynamic and struggle going on between fans and Vince McMahon that really, I think, started at WrestleMania 30. Well, before that, with getting Daniel Bryan there, but really culminated at WrestleMania 30 and having Daniel Bryan win WrestleMania 30, the main event, solely because of fan support.
Yeah, it's just something that, like, everyone, you know, even WWE, like, always, you know, shows the flashbacks to it. It was such a great moment in history, and it's just like, but then why are you resisting it? If it was such a great moment, like, why don't you allow for something for that to happen again? And I don't buy this whole Kofi thing. Obviously, you and I have been very vocal how we felt about that, but, like, Kofi Kingston was not even in the same realm of Daniel Bryan. That was so manufactured. I won't go back down that rabbit hole for the umpteenth time. But it's like, and I've kind of said this a lot now, but I'll sound like a broken record, but I'll say it again, that unless you were a guy out of the Shield or Brock Lesnar or AJ Styles over the last 5 years, like, you probably had a snowball chance in hell of getting into that elite level. And, you know, even Kevin Owens, like, everyone thought, you know, when they did that rebrand split in 2016 where Stephanie got Raw and Shane got SmackDown, Kevin Owens took the Universal Championship. And for all intents and purposes, he was the first ever Universal Champion. I know Finn Balor was, but he held it for a day. Kevin Owens was the first guy to really have a run as Universal Champion, and he's dropped it to Goldberg and has yet to be back since. And it's just like, I'm not saying that there's never any other champion than a Shield guy or Brock or AJ, but it's just no guy that you can take serious on a long-term basis. It's like, you got Kevin Owens, it was a one-off. You got Kofi Kingston, it was a one-off. Kind of Daniel Bryan, it was a one-off, but he's kind of stayed on equal footing with the likes of the Shield guys and AJ and Brock. So it's just a lot of this. It's a lot of the same group of five wrestlers or so. And I could say Tudera was Rock, Austin, Leach, and Tate. No, because you had Mankind come in and win multiple championships. Chris Jericho was born in on the backs of those guys and beating The Rock and Stone Cold Steve Austin the same night. And he had several world championships. Kurt Angle had several world championship runs. And even though it was centered around The Rock and Austin and Triple H and Undertaker, you still had other guys who were always taken as legitimate threats to be world champions in Angle and Jericho and Mick Foley. And you just don't see it a lot of lately. You'll never see, like, you could watch a match of Chris Jericho versus The Rock, like they had at the Royal Rumble in 2002 for the Undisputed Championship, and be like, wow, it's realistic that Jericho won this. Nowadays, if Roman Reigns fights Baron Corbin, you know that Roman Reigns is going to eventually come out on top in that program, because unless Roman Reigns is standing toe-to-toe with Seth Rollins, AJ Styles, or Brock Lesnar, we know that WWE is putting him one step above the rest.
There is a clear pecking order with when it comes to baby faces, and when they face heels, we know, like you said, it's not even a remote possibility that, for example, as you said, Baron Corbin would beat Roman Reigns in a straight up match. It's just not going to happen. It's just a fait accompli that Roman Reigns is going to always win if given a fair, no interference, just straight up match, that he can beat anyone. I mean, that's just the narrative that we've been fed, that Roman Reigns can beat anybody as long as there's no interference. And I don't ever feel that Roman Reigns is in danger of losing to a heel that maybe is better than him and in a fair fight could beat him. And I don't want that feeling. I want the feeling that maybe Roman Reigns could lose this even without the heel cheating. It doesn't always have to be a heel cheating. It's a good, just terrible thing to have as a characteristic for a heel in a good way. I mean, that's what you want, but not always. I mean, take, for example, Drew McIntyre, as we just discussed. He could still be a great heel and a heel that doesn't have to cheat to win. He's a guy that you could really believe could beat Roman Reigns, although we've been told, you know, in how many matches that Roman Reigns is still better straight up. But he's a guy that you believe could straight up beat Roman Reigns and brag about it and be obnoxious about it. And, you know, who the hell is going to take this guy down? And I just don't feel that way. You just don't have heels that are believable in today's 2019 to take out baby faces without having to do the typical, you know, distraction or, you know, making baby faces look like fools or whatever. So yeah, you're totally right.
Yeah. And I'm not, and this isn't to say that there shouldn't be a hierarchy, because there, you know, not everyone can stand toe to toe with the rest, but it's just something that you need to leave the door open for, you know, a new guy to take the reins. Like, we would never see nowadays a situation like when Brock Lesnar beat The Rock at SummerSlam 2002, and you did a wrestling nostalgia on that. And it just, every once in a while, you have to have these moments that usher in, like, a new dominant phase. And it's just, in WWE now, it doesn't happen enough. And you just get the same guys over and over again, and it's just almost like a filtration system. And once again, we're going to see Roman Reigns and Brock Lesnar in the main event of WrestleMania, granted on respective brands, but they're both going to be there. And then, okay, it's great that Bray Wyatt has the WWE Championship now, but again, like, he was another guy who got a short run with the title a few years back and then lost it to Randy Orton after a month and a half. And you hope that this isn't a similar fate with him. It's just, I want to be able to go into WrestleMania 36 and say, like, man, The Fiend may actually win this match. And if that was the case, I probably wouldn't be so negative heading into it. But now, you know, it's almost like a predetermined thing that I know that Roman Reigns is going to go in and beat The Fiend and probably end The Fiend's run here as a really beloved character. And just to tie it back to where we started with Cena and HBK, I went into that match really not sure who was going to win, because we had touched on Cena had yet to really solidify himself as the next guy of WWE. And HBK, well, he's HBK. He's one of the best of all time. And I just feel that nowadays we don't get that enough where you could actually see the young guy overtake an established star who's been there for 4 or 5 plus years.
I mean, the only example that I can think of where we all believe Roman was going to win, for example, was him, Roman versus Brock Lesnar at WrestleMania 34, or was it 35? No, 34.
Yeah.
And having a, oh, he's definitely going to win, and Roman didn't win. And then you get to the greatest Royal Rumble. Oh, Roman's going to win, and he didn't win. I think it was a steel cage match with Brock Lesnar. And then you finally get to SummerSlam, and boom, they finally pull the trigger. I think that was more of a case of WWE and Vince McMahon saying, oh, everyone believes Roman's going to win. Let's, you know, let's swerve him. And rather than having it actually have a higher purpose of ushering in someone new, it was just the purpose of, well, let's just do it because this is what people don't expect to happen. So they did it a couple times and then eventually just got to where we all thought they were going to be. And just, it was almost as if during that whole 6 month span of just go, we all know you're going to do it. Just do it. Stop playing with us. Just put the belt on him so we can get through his reign and, you know, wait for him to drop it to somebody else. I mean, that's how I felt. I wasn't excited when he lost to Brock Lesnar because I knew that eventually it was going to happen anyway. And they were just delaying the inevitable. It's like, you know, you're sitting there at the doctor's office about to get a shot and they just keep getting the needle close to your arm and then pulling away. It's just like, just effing do it. I mean, that's how I felt with it. And then we finally got it. And so, yeah, you're right. I mean, I would like that excitement of, hey, this up-and-coming guy or gal, could they have the opportunity to dethrone the guy or gal? I always have to make sure I'm equal footing here. That is at the top. Could we see that at WrestleMania, which is typically the place to do it, where things change and torches are passed and all of this symbolism that happens at WrestleMania, but it's true. It's the time and place to do it in most cases. And I just don't feel that from WrestleMania to WrestleMania lately, outside of, like you said, WrestleMania 31 with the cash in of Seth Rollins, which I still love that. And that's just such a brilliant ending. And to Michael Cole's credit, when he said the heist of the century, that still is a perfect, I don't know if it was a planned phrase or not, but I loved it. So, I know we're getting a bit off topic here, but I do have some audio from the match of John Cena and HBK that I would like to play. Hold on, I lost it. So while I pull that up, do you have any other comments?
You brought up Wrestling 34 with Reigns and Lesnar, and I was just thinking back off the top of my head, and there was no real big title changes that match. You know, AJ retained against Shinsuke. Charlotte retained against Asuka, obviously Brock retained against Roman. And then the big title change in the night, aside from Nia Jax taking the Raw Women's Championship away from Alexa Bliss, was probably Seth Rollins winning the Intercontinental Championship in the opening match of the night. It was a weird time, WrestleMania 34, because there was no major title changes. You know, Brock retained against Roman, AJ retained against Shinsuke, Charlotte retaining against Asuka. The big title change of the night was pretty much Seth winning the Intercontinental Championship in the opening triple threat match. And I guess Nia Jax did beat Alexa Bliss for the Raw Women's title, but that was kind of underwhelming. But it was just weird that, you know, three major championships and two major men championships didn't change hands there.
Yeah, that was a little strange. And the rumors of Nia Jax returning are just swirling everywhere. I don't know. I would assume from everything I'm seeing and hearing that Nia Jax is close to returning. I would assume as a heel. I think she's much better positioned as a heel. I think she's just naturally obnoxious on and off camera. So I'll keep my personal thoughts about her to myself. But as a character on air, I think she's much better positioned to be a heel. So rumors of her swirling. And honestly, I'm excited for her to come back. I think the women's division needs a little bit of a shakeup on both brands. And if Ronda Rousey is ever going to return, which I don't know. I mean, there's always that possibility looming, and we're starting to close into WrestleMania season. So with Ronda Rousey maybe on the horizon, I think the women's division is in for a bit of a shakeup, whether it is Ronda Rousey or it is Nia Jax. But I'm excited. Maybe even some call-ups from NXT.
Yeah, no, I'd welcome a Nia Jax introduction. I think more so the SmackDown side. I feel like the SmackDown women have some improvement to do, at least in that respect. But, you know, I would look forward to see Nia Jax coming back and possibly gaining some momentum as she did in the past.
Very good. Well, let's I have to get to some audio because that's just like a thing that I love to do to make sure that, you know, you guys can hear and listen, or listen to, rather, some of the audio from this match of John Cena versus HBK at WrestleMania 23. It's very short. I'm probably like, I don't know, 20, 30 seconds. But just to give you a bit of a here and now feeling of this match, this is towards the end. John Cena had just put HBK in the STFU, which then just became the STF, and HBK crawled out of it, got to the ropes, and John Cena is arguing with the referee as, well, just take a listen, and you can probably guess what's coming.
On the referee, Michaels saw the whole scene, took advantage of Michaels, and delivered Sweet Chin Music. There was no sympathy for Cena.
Now, Shawn Michaels, you got to cover Cena. This is your, this may be your only opportunity.
Michaels keeps putting out the hits. With a bullet for Sweet Chin Music. Will it be enough? These men are giving everything they've got here tonight. The arm over. Will it be? No, no. Cena will not.
Oh my God, check this out one more time. Cena turns right into the super kick from the Showstopper.
Oh man, I get caught up watching it, and as I'm watching it, and obviously hearing it is different than seeing it, but the emotion that was on Michael's face after he hit the super kick, both men are down, and once Michael's kind of gains the energy back to crawl over to make the cover, I mean, just that those few seconds really spoke volumes about just how awesome a wrestling match can be in those moments, because what I saw was Shawn Michaels crawling over with everything that he had in such a believable, almost as if he was crying. Like, I mean, it sounds silly, but when you watch that moment of him almost in tears of everything he has in him to try to make that cover to win the match, that is what's called a ring psychology. That's what's called bringing you in with an emotional investment. It's just, it's damn brilliant.
Yeah, HBK was amazing at that. You know, like, just his facial expressions. Like, I remember WrestleMania 20 with Benoit and Triple H after they double suplex Benoit to the announce table, and Michaels is back in the ring, and he's covered in blood, or the crimson mask, as JR would say, and he was just, like, egging on Triple H to get in the ring to, you know, finish what they started all those years ago in DX. And Shawn Michaels, he was my cousin's favorite wrestler, and he was never one of my favorite. Once he left, like, I grew a greater appreciation for, because you just knew that no matter what storyline you threw him in, no matter what title picture, obviously he didn't really hold any singles titles when he came back in 2002, aside from his one world heavyweight title win, but he was just always good to give you an A-plus match and A-plus angle. And, you know, like, I remember him captaining Team Raw in Survivor Series 2005, and, like, how great and how intriguing he made that storyline. And then if he could make something like that so, like, appealing and draw you in so much, a match like this of this magnitude with an up-and-coming star like Cena, you know, it was just really something to see. And Shawn Michaels' ability to draw you in and really, you know, attach your heart to the match was something that I haven't seen since.
He's a damn master. I mean, I was getting, in those 30 seconds, I was getting into it. It's just, it's amazing. And I would recommend that anybody listening, if you haven't seen this match, you have to. And if you have, I'd recommend you see it again, because it will feel like it's the first time you've seen it. It's definitely one of the best WrestleMania matches I've seen in terms of psychology, pacing, emotional investment, all those things that make what pro wrestling is and why we all love it, and probably why you're listening to this podcast great. That is all inclusive in that match. So, Anthony, I mean, I could talk about this forever, but I know that we can't. And I know that, hey, I got to get up early for work, and we all have commitments. But Is there anything else about this match or anything else that you wanted to comment on before we close things out?
Man, no, I think we really touched everything. You know, we talked a good bit about like how it relates to nowadays, and I think maybe it's an unfair standard to hold current matches to, but I think that when you think across the board of up and coming stars going against older veterans and like how you want to cement a guy as the future, like this is kind of the standard barrier in all of those kind of regards.
It is. I mean, yes, there are other matches that are as good or maybe even better, but this can't, you can't put WrestleMania matches in the top 10 without including this match. It has to be somewhere in, I believe, the top 10. Maybe right up there with HBK Kurt Angle. I mean, that was another match that was absolutely, I mean, off the charts too, but in a different way. And so, yeah, this is one that I think got lost by a lot of fans, even lost by myself on just how good it was and the story and not just the story of the match itself, but the build up to it and everything that went along with it and really the passing of the torch and an end of an era and all that stuff that really culminated at 23. And I was actually, it's funny you mentioned that you were 12 years old when you watched this. I was actually on spring break in Panama City, Florida, passed out drunk. I don't even remember watching this match live. I had to watch it back because I had passed out after the Big Show match, or not Big Show. I think it was after Bobby Lashley and Umaga. So that's how I don't remember this match. So it's funny you mentioned that. But yes, anybody, you need to see this. It's a must watch if you are a wrestling fan. And it's been a blast talking to you, Anthony. And but obviously, before you go, let everyone know how they can get in touch with you on social media.
Oh, my Twitter handle is at ADeMarco25. Tweet me whatever. I may or may not answer.
Or if it's hockey. No, we all know. No, yeah. No. If it's hockey related, you will.
Yeah, if it's hockey related, I will. But if it's something that I find is an asinine comment, I may come after you.
What are you talking about? Twitter's a very well-behaved social media platform. I don't know what you're saying. I mean, I've never been attacked. And people, yeah, no. No. It's just sometimes a cesspool. It's just what it is. I mean, the majority of people are very respectful, and I have no issues. But just like anywhere, you know, you get people hiding behind their little keyboards, and that's fine. It's just what it is. But anyway, yeah, no, it really is. It's the nature of the beast, and just take the good with the bad. But anyway, yeah, definitely tweet at ADeMarco25, and especially with hockey. I know that you're a huge hockey fan. I haven't been following a whole lot lately, but I know that we're in full swing of the season now.
Oh yeah, you're well into I would say approaching the halfway point, but well past the quarter mark of the season.
Yeah. Oof. Well, yeah, either that or as we get into the politics of 2022, I mean, I'm sure, although you're in Canada, so you don't maybe have a vested interest in who's going to win the 2020 presidential election, but you get to sit and be a bystander in all of the insanity that's going to happen over the next 11 months.
Oh, yeah. We still get it up here. You know, most of our news up here has to do with your news down there. So although we're not directly involved with it, we're directly affected by it.
All right. Well, enjoy the circus over the next 11 months. I will say that. It's been a blast having you on the show. And as we get to normally on Saturday, the schedule with some of my co-hosts and myself with the holidays and other things that have been going on, I believe, is this your week? I think it is anyway.
Yeah, I think this is my week either way. So I guess since it's Saturday, we did it tonight.
All right. Well, then I will talk to you in a few days. And it's been a blast discussing this match, and we'll be in touch very soon.
All right, Matt. Talk soon.
All right. Take care.